This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Egypt's former president Hosni Mubarak has died at 91.
He was a dictator and he was overthrown by the will of the people. However, he was not held accountable for all the crimes that he has done.
Also ahead, the World Food Program estimates 7.7 million people will need food aid in Zimbabwe. Plus, dozens of Cameroonian civilians face dire health conditions after taking refuge in an orphanage to escape the country's civil war. Stay tuned for these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has died today at 91. The late autocrat was seen as a symbol of both stability and repression and was ousted in a 2011 popular uprising that helped set off a wave of protests known as the Arab Spring against dictators across the Middle East and North Africa. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett looks back at the man who some called a modern pharaoh.
Hosni Mubarak held power for nearly 30 years and, like many Arab leaders of his time, made his country a personal fiefdom. He placed friends and family in positions of power and appeared to be grooming his son to succeed him. Until 18 stunning days in early 2011, when it all came to an end, his vice president announced the news.
In these difficult circumstances that Egypt is going through, President Mubarak decided to resign from his post as the president, and he requested the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to run the affairs of the country, and God help us all.
Within months, he was in a courtroom cage on trial for the killing of protesters. He was sentenced to life in prison. It was an almost unthinkable political end to the man who was the only president most Egyptians knew. Yet the presidency was not something he had sought. In 1981, Islamists killed President Anwar Sadat in part for making peace with Israel. Vice President Mubarak was by his side. The assassins propelled him to the leadership of the country. During the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, Mubarak had risen to fame as head of Egypt's Air Force. That made him unlikely to carry forward the peace deal with Israel. But with huge financial incentives from the United States, he remained committed to the treaty. At the same time, he mended relations with Arab nations that had shunned Egypt for its overture. To keep the peace at home, he instituted emergency laws, an emergency that lasted for decades. Hussein Abdul Razak is the former head of the left-wing Tagamo Party.
The most important objective he sought is to achieve stability and security.
That security came at a price, with rights groups and opponents claiming widespread torture. On the economic front, Mubarak promised reforms, but poverty and unemployment grew. When Islamic extremists killed Egyptians and foreign tourists, Mubarak cracked down. But in doing so, he also marginalized moderate Islamists, only increasing their grassroots support. According to political analyst Hisham Qasim, Mubarak, more than anything, lacked a vision.
We're not talking only about somebody who was really the chargé d'affaires of a country for 30 years and practically did nothing, okay? He was like the Mr. Night Shift, out there to hand over the place to the morning shift. This is his legacy. But he was ultra-corrupt.
Some say it was the grooming of his son Gamal that proved the final straw. Syed Sadek of the American University in Cairo.
If you look at, especially since this succession project started, that his son would take over, the popularity of this regime declined tremendously.
Sadek says the middle class, hurt by Mr. Mubarak's policies, led the revolt against him. But even during his trial, he had his supporters. Mr. Mubarak saw himself as a paternal figure. It's an image he played upon in his final days in office.
Hassan!
But his defiance only reminded the protesters of his refusal to do more for his country while in power. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Despite his initial downfall and trial after Egypt's 2011 revolution, Mubarak was released from prison after fellow general and current Egyptian president Abdel Fattah el-Sisi took power in 2014. In the end, Mubarak died a free man. For more on Mubarak's death and legacy, I spoke earlier today with Mina Thabet, an Egyptian activist who is head of policy at the Egyptian Commission for Rights and Freedoms in London.
I believe the legacy that Mubarak left, that he is the autocrat that ruled the country for more than three decades. He corrupted our country, corrupted the infrastructure of our political system. And he left Egypt like a political kind of desert after we successfully get him out of authority in 2011. We struggled, the country struggled. There was no parties that were available to grab authority or to handle the country. Most of the youth movement was soon crushed because it was young, it was inexperienced, and it was crushed by the military from which he came. He was a dictator who hung on to authority, and he was overthrown by the will of the people. However, he didn't face justice. He was not held accountable for all the crimes that he has done. That is his legacy.
How does that impact today's Egypt? Of course, after the revolution, there was the first democratic election, which brought Mohamed Morsi to power, but then he himself was overthrown. And now there is Abdel el-Sisi, who is somewhat of a throwback to the Mubarak era in some ways. Does Mubarak's legacy live on today in some way in today's Egypt?
Well, I believe that Mubarak, since 2014, Mubarak became history. Since Sisi got to power and grabbed the power, I believe we had a new Egypt, and we had a new autocrat. We had a new Mubarak, but far worse and less experienced and more ferocious or more harsh on opposition. And we have seen, under his rule, we are seeing now an alarming amount of pressure on public life and exceedingly crackdown on human rights defenders on public sphere in Egypt. So I believe Mubarak to be a history. However, it is a clear sign that someone, that like a dictator like Mubarak now, didn't face justice, like die at 90, at plus 90, didn't face justice for the crimes that he had committed. He had committed in our life and the damage that he had done to our people. And finally, he died like between his family, he died born. Like other people are dying in jail now, like other people dying in jail, they don't find enough medical care, they don't die with their families. But he had a chance, after three decades of dictatorship, he had a chance to die in peace. But a lot of other people, a lot of critics and a lot of political activists are dying now in Sisi's jail. So I believe that Mubarak is a history. It doesn't change anything, but it gives us an alarm about Sisi, who is now establishing his new autocratic regime.
That was Mina Thabet, the head of policy at the Egyptian Commission for Rights and Freedoms in London. The World Food Program says it needs $103 million to meet urgent food assistance needs in Zimbabwe, where more than half the population is food insecure due to recurring droughts and an ailing economy. Columbus Mavunga reports for VOA from Eastern Mudzi District, one of the country's most affected areas.
Zimbabwe's Mudzi District, on the border with Mozambique, is one of the areas most affected by severe food shortages. 75-year-old farmer Justina Marimbindi says years of recurring drought decimated her crops and now depends on monthly food handouts of cowpeas, cooking oil, and cornmeal.
She says, my granary is now empty. And pointing to her field with stunted crop, she adds, we farm, but it doesn't bear fruits. I sold my goats. There's no hope that there's anything that will come out of the fields. We depend on these handouts, she said, pointing her handouts from UN's WFP. But not every Zimbabwean who needs food aid is getting it. 94-year-old Rudia Rukwenya was turned away at the local distribution center. She says, I was told that my name is not on the list. Maybe they'll give me next time. For now, I have to depend on my daughter, said seated to her 67-year-old daughter, Edith Mutusa, and adding that, that's why I have come to her home after I was not given anything. But she needs food assistance too, as her crops failed and she needs to feed her children, she said. An ongoing wave of rains in the area is bringing some hope. But Robert Mzezewa, the Muzi district coordinator, says that may be a little too late in a country where the World Food Programme says about 7.7 million people will require food aid until the next harvest, expected between April and July.
The situation can be as bad because a lot of people who planted during the first rains, their crops have not fared well and they were burned by the sun. And that also will maybe cause the food security situation bad.
For years, food insecurity situation was mainly for rural folks. But this time, WFP Assistant Executive Director Valerie Guarnieri says it's affecting both rural and urban dwellers.
Difficult for rural populations who are struggling with the lack of rain to grow enough food to meet their needs, and difficult for urban populations who are unable to find the piecemeal work that they normally rely on and are seeing rising prices and sometimes stock shortfalls in the shops. So we're scaling up our programs, but in order to sustain urgent food assistance and resilience programs, we need an additional $103 million for the next 6 months.
But even if food supplies can recover, Zimbabwe's struggling economy and sky-high inflation will continue to squeeze the country's most vulnerable. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Muzi, Zimbabwe.
Human rights groups Amnesty International and the Committee to Protect Journalists say they have mixed feelings about yesterday's release from prison of prominent Tanzanian investigative journalist Eric Kabendera. They say Kabendera, who agreed to plead guilty to secure his freedom but still must pay over $119,000 in fines, should never have been imprisoned in the first place. Amnesty's Tanzania researcher Roland Ebole explains their stance to VOA's Salem Solomon.
Eric Kabendera is free. Free in terms of, in a human rights language, you can say that he bought his freedom, considering that he had to go into a plea bargaining for the authorities to set him free. Remember, Eric Kabendera was arrested on 29 July last year. And when he was arrested, authorities said that they were arresting him over citizenship as an offences. They were questioning him over his nationality. Later on, they questioned him over sedition with regards to something that he had written. And it later changed to become economic crimes, where they had three counts against him. That was money laundering, organized crimes, and failure to pay tax. So what we see right now is that Eric Kabendera has been pushed to a corner over a long period of time, because you recall that when he was in custody, at some point his health deteriorated, where he had difficulty in breathing. He had issues where one of his legs had some form of paralysis. Later on, you remember when in custody, his mother was unwell and died. That was on 31st of December last year. His family is not in Dressland because they have been in hiding for a while. So you can imagine the kind of pressure that Eric Kabendera has been in, to a point that when he was pushed into the corner, he really had to go for a plea. But we believe that they are still trumped up charges and they should have been dropped. But of course, with Eric Kabendera and really wanting to be free to end all this agony, he was free to do what he chose to do.
That was Amnesty International's Tanzania researcher Roland Ebele speaking about the arrest and release of investigative journalist Eric Kabendera. The Commission for Gender Equality in South Africa has made shocking revelations on how women have been forcibly sterilized in public hospitals and clinics. The commission, which makes legally binding recommendations, has demanded strong action against perpetrators. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Tamara Matebula, chairperson of the Commission for Gender Equality, CGE, in South Africa, told a media briefing today that they established this inhuman practice after investigating 48 documented cases. She said in the majority of cases, women living with HIV were targeted. Transgender women also reported that they were being forced to sterilize. Matebula said this was gross human rights violation.
One of the complainants in her affidavit narrated the following. The nurse told me, "You HIV people, you must be closed up because of your HIV status. Because you HIV people like making babies. And it just annoys us."
Under this illegal practice, pregnant women were coerced to sign sterilization consent forms with no information on the consequences of sterilization given. Some were forced to sign while in excruciating labor pains, leaving them with no room of choice. Women's rights organizations have described the practice as deplorable and are demanding that perpetrators be brought to book. Victress Matutu is the chairperson of Imbogodo, an organization fighting for the rights of women in South Africa and other countries.
It's shocking. How can officials do that? Who on earth does such a barbaric act? As a woman, I see this as a serious violation of women's rights. No one has the right to act such on anyone's body without her consent. You can't make someone sign on such an issue during labor. During that time, the woman is not even thinking straight. She's not in her normal senses.
The commission has directed that stern action be taken against the implicated officials and that the Department of Health takes measures that will ensure the practice never occurs.
The National Department of Health must interrogate and scrutinize the provisions of the Sterilization Act to ascertain as to what concrete steps the department will take in order to ensure that the eradication of the harmful practices of forced sterilization is dealt with once and for all.
According to the commission, some of the affected women had suffered depression as a result, while others reported that they had been divorced by their partners as they could not bear children anymore. The commission has also recommended that all women choosing to sterilize should be given time to rethink their decision after full information has been given to them about the consequences of their decision. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Renewed fighting in Cameroon's restive English-speaking region has forced more than 70 people, mainly women and children, to flee for their lives and seek shelter at an orphanage. Many of them, however, are very ill, battling malaria and severe malnutrition. Others are dealing with fresh wounds from the fighting between government's troops and separatist fighters. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited the orphanage and reports for VOA from the English-speaking town of Bamenda.
They look tired, hungry, unkempt and sick. The victims of the separatist violence in the English-speaking northwestern Minchum administrative unit say that in the past 2 weeks, they have escaped escalating conflict. Comfort Finney, a 23-year-old mother of two, says she fled Minchum when men dressed in military uniforms torched the 32 houses in their village. Finney says the violence took the lives of her husband and oldest daughter.
I'm from far. We're just living in the village. Some people just come and burn our village. So we run and go to the bush, to the forest. We make two weeks in the forest before coming out.
Finney says the military, along with health workers with the Roman Catholic Church, rescued her in the locality of Wum. Finney says she has been living at the orphanage for close to 1 week. Most of the victims are children and women who say they were molested by both the military and separatist fighters. 55-year-old Moses Kum is one of only five men in the group of escapees. Kum says he does not know if his second wife and two children are still alive, adding that he spent several days in the bush foraging.
Cutting fruits in the bush and managing to live. So we thank God that God helped us to strike for 3 days before reaching Bafmen.
Humanitarian workers with the Roman Catholic Church and Red Cross took Kum and eight others from the town of Bafmen to the orphanage. Health worker Pete Ngwa says taking care of the displaced is a challenge because of a lack of resources.
We are focused on malaria, which we know is passed by mosquitoes are mostly common in the bushes where we are staying. We are concerned about HB, blood level, which is mostly linked to nutrition. So when we test these parameters, we can give an advice to them based on the result on how to go about to remedy the situation.
Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says when he was informed about the critical situation facing the fleeing victims, he alerted President Paul Biya. Nji says the government will dispatch immediate humanitarian assistance.
When the governor gave me the report, my immediate reaction was that let us come and visit the place, give the first assistance, what they call first aid. Then after we see gradually what can be done. You can see the material that we have brought from the humanitarian plan of action given by President Paul Biya. And at the same time, we'll provide some financial assistance because they need medication, they need special attention.
Nji denied allegations the military was responsible for some of the atrocities. Rights group Human Rights Watch has always blamed both government troops and separatist fighters for gross human rights violations, saying that Cameroonian security forces respond to increasing attacks by armed separatist groups by burning homes and other property in villages across the northwest and southwest regions. Human Rights Watch also accuses armed separatist groups of killing, torture, assault, and kidnapping of dozens of people. Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to detach English-speaking northwest and southwest Cameroon from the rest of the country and its French-speaking majority. The secessionist uprising has left 3,000 people dead and forced 500,000 others to flee either to the French-speaking regions or into neighboring Nigeria, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
A U.S. airstrike in a town held by Somali Islamist insurgents killed a telecommunications worker, his employees said on Tuesday, as the U.S. military's Africa Command said it was investigating the report. Monday's strike in the Al-Shabaab stronghold of Jilib killed Mohamed Haji Salad, a site manager for Hormuud, Somalia's biggest telecoms company. The company said that Mr. Salad was highly respected among his colleagues and was known to be a good father to his children. AFRICOM, which is the U.S. Africa Command, confirmed the airstrike in Jilib and said it was investigating. AFRICOM carried out 63 airstrikes in Somalia last year and has carried out 18 this year. That wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening to The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.